other, admirable and capable of generating hope. Why can't we make the experiment and find out if it is true? The Divinity of Interest. The following is from Carl Jung's Psychology and Alchemy. The central ideas of Christianity are rooted in Gnostic philosophy, which, in accordance with psychological laws, simply had to grow up at a time when the classical religions had become obsolete. It was founded on the perception of symbols thrown up by the unconscious individuation process, which always sets in when the collective dominance of human life falls into decay. At such a time, there is bound to be a considerable number of individuals who are possessed by archetypes of a numinous nature that force their way to the surface in order to form new dominance. This state of possession shows itself almost without exception in the fact that the possessed identify themselves with the archetypal contents of their unconscious, and because they do not realize that the role which is being thrust upon them is the effect of new contents still to be understood, they exemplify these concretely in their own lives, thus becoming prophets and reformers. Insofar as the archetypal content of the Christian drama was able to give satisfying expression to the uneasy and clamorous unconscious of the many, the consensus omnium raised this drama to a universally binding truth, not, of course, by an act of judgment, but by the irrational fact of possession, which is far more effective. Thus, Jesus became the tutelary image or amulet against the archetypal powers that threatened to possess everyone. The glad tidings announced, "It has happened, but it will not happen to you inasmuch as you believe in Jesus Christ, the Son of God." Yet it could, and it can, and it will happen to everyone in whom the Christian dominant has decayed. For this reason, there have always been people who, not satisfied with the dominance of conscious life, set forth, under cover and by devious paths, to their destruction or salvation, to seek direct experience of the eternal roots, and, following the lure of the restless unconscious psyche, find themselves in the wilderness where, like Jesus, they come up against the Son of Darkness. Thus, an old alchemist, and he a cleric, prays, "Purge the horrible darknesses of our minds, light a light for our senses." The author of this sentence must have been undergoing the experience of the negredo, the first stage of the work, which was felt as melancholia in alchemy and corresponds to the encounter with the shadow in psychology. When, therefore, modern psychotherapy once more meets with the activated archetypes of the collective unconscious, it is merely the repetition of a phenomenon that has been observed in moments of great religious crisis, although it can also occur in individuals for whom the ruling ideas have lost their meaning. An example of this is the dissensus ad inferos in Faust, which, consciously or unconsciously, is an opus alchemicum. The problem of opposites called up by the shadow plays a great, indeed the decisive, role in alchemy, since it leads in the ultimate phase of the work to the union of opposites in the archetypal form of the hieros gamos or chymical wedding. Here the supreme opposites, male and female, as in the Chinese yin and yang, are melted into a unity, purified of all opposition, and therefore incorruptible. The following is a letter I wrote to my father in November of 1986. Dear Dad, I promised you that one day I would tell you what the book I am trying to write is supposed to be about. I haven't been working on it much in the last month, although in some regards it is always on my mind, and everything I learn in my other work has some bearing upon it. Because I have abandoned it temporarily, I thought perhaps I could tell you about it, and that would help me organize my thoughts. I don't completely understand the driving force behind what I have been working on, although I understand it better now than I used to 3 or 4 years ago when it was literally driving me crazy. I'd been obsessed with the idea of war for 3 or 4 years prior to that, often dreaming extremely violent dreams centered around the theme of destruction. I believe now that my concern with death on a mass scale was intimately tied into my personal life, and that concerns with the meaning of life on a personal level, which arise with the contemplation of death, took a general form for me, which had to do with the value of humanity and the purpose of life in general. Carl Jung has suggested that all personal problems are relevant to society because we are all so much alike, and that any sufficiently profound solution to a personal problem may, if communicated, reduce the likelihood of that problem existing in anyone else's experience in the future. This is, in fact, how society and the individual support one another. It was in this way that my concern with war, which is the application of death on the general level, led me into concepts and ideas concerning the meaning of life on the personal level, which I could never have imagined as relevant or believable prior to learning about them, and which I still believe border on what might normally be considered insanity. The reasons for war, many believe, are rooted in politics. Since it is groups of men that fight, and since groups indulge in politics, this belief seems well-founded and in fact contains some truth. It is just as true, however, that it is a good thing to look for something you don't want to find in a place where you know it won't be, and the modern concern with global politics and the necessity to be involved in a good cause rather than to live responsibly seems to me to be evidence that the desire not to find often overpowers the real search for truth. You see, it is true that people don't want the truth, because the truth destroys what lack of faith erects and the false comfort it contains. It is not possible to live in the world that you wish could be and in the real world at the same time, and it often seems a bad bargain to destroy fantasy for reality. It is desire for lack of responsibility that underlies this evasion, in part, but it is also fear of possibility. At least this is how it seems to me. Because everyone is a product of their times, and because that applies to me as well, I looked for what I wanted to find where it was obvious to everyone it would be, in politics, in political science, in the study of group behavior. This took up the years I spent involved with the NDP and in studying political science until I learned that the application of a system of thought like socialism, or any other ism for that matter, to a problem and solving that problem were not the same thing. In the former case, you have someone who is not you to blame. The rich, the Americans, the white people, the government, the system, whatever. As long as it is someone else. I came to realize slowly that a problem of global proportions existed as a problem because everyone on the globe thought and acted to maintain that problem. Now what that means is that if the problem has a solution, then what everyone thinks is wrong. And that meant, too, that what I thought had to be fundamentally wrong. Now the problem with this line of reasoning is simple. It leads inexorably to the following conclusion. The more fundamental the problem, the more fundamental the error, in my own viewpoint. I came to believe that survival itself, and more, depended upon a solution to the problem of war. This made me consider that perhaps everything I believed was wrong. This consideration was not particularly pleasant, and was severely complicated by the fact that I had also come to realize that, although I definitely believed a variety of things, I did not always know what I believed, and when I knew what, I did not know why. You see, history itself conditioned everything I believed, even when I did not know it, and it was sheer unconscious arrogance that made me posit to begin with that I had half a notion of who or what I was or what the process of history had created and how I was affected by that creation. It is one thing to be unconscious of the answers and quite another to be unable to even consider the question. I had a notion that confronting what terrified me, what turned my dreams against me, could help me withstand that terrible thing. This idea, granted me by the grace of God allowed me to believe that I could find what I most wanted if I could tolerate the truth, if I was willing to follow wherever it led me, if I was willing to devote my life to acting upon what I had discovered, whatever that might be, without reservation, knowing somehow that once started, an aborted attempt would destroy at least my self-respect, at most, my sanity and desire to live. I believe now that everyone has this choice in front of them, even when they do not know or refuse to admit it, that everyone makes this choice with every decision and action they take. I mentioned earlier that history conditioned what I think and acted. Pursuit of this realization, which is rather self-evident once realized, has led me to the study of history as a psychological phenomenon. You see, if what I think and am is a product of history, that means that history must take form inside me, so to speak, and from inside me determine who I am. This is easier to understand if you consider that I carry around inside me an image of you, composed of memories of how you act and what you expected and depictions of your behavior. This image has had profound impact on how I behaved as a child, when, even in your absence, I was compelled to follow the rules which you followed and which I learned through imitation and which you instilled into me through praise and punishment. Sometimes that image of you in me even takes the form of a personality when I dream about you. So it is a straightforward matter to believe, from the psychological point of view, that each individual carries around an image of his parents, and that this image governs his behavior, at least in part. But you see, it is the case that the rules that you followed, and which I learned from you, were not rules that you yourself created, but rather those that you handed to me just as you had been handed them while still a child. And it is more than likely true that the majority of what I learned from you was never verbalized, that the rules which governed the way you acted and that I learned while watching you were implicit in your behavior and are now implicit in mine. It was exactly in this manner that I learned language, mostly from watching and listening, partly from explicit instruction. And just as it is certainly possible, and most commonly so, to speak correctly and yet to be unable to describe the rules of grammar that underlie the production of language, it is possible to act upon the world and make assumptions about its nature without knowing much about the values and beliefs that necessarily underlie those actions and assumptions. The structure of our language has been created in a historical process, and is, in a sense, an embodiment of that process. The structure of that which governs our actions and perceptions has also been created during the course of history, and is the embodiment of history. The implications of this idea overwhelmed me. I have been attempting to consider history itself as a unitary phenomenon, as a single thing, in a sense, in order to understand what it is and how it affects what I think and do. If you realize that history is in some sense in your head, and you also realize that you know nothing of the significance of history, of its meaning, which is almost certainly true, then you must realize that you know nothing of the significance of yourself and of your own meaning. I'm writing my book in an attempt to explain the psychological significance of history, to explain the meaning of history. In doing so, I have discovered a number of interesting things. Number one, all cultures, excepting the Western, do not possess a history based on objective events. The history of alternative cultures, even those as highly developed as the Indian, Chinese, and ancient Greco-Roman, is mythological, which means that it describes what an event meant in psychological terms instead of how it happened in empirical terms. Number two, all cultures, even those most disparate in nature, develop among broadly predictable lines and have, within their mythological history, certain constant features, just as all languages share grammatical structure given a sufficiently abstract analysis. The lines along which culture develops are determined biologically, and the rules which govern that development are the consequence of the psychological expression of neurophysiological structures. This thesis will be the most difficult for me to prove, but I have some solid evidence in its favor, and as I study more neuroanatomy and neuropsychology, the evidence becomes clearer. Number 3. Mythological renditions of history, like those in the Bible, are just as true as the standard Western empirical renditions, just as literally true, but how they are true is different. Western historians describe, or think they describe, what happened. The traditions of mythology and religion describe the significance of what happened. And it must be noted that if what happens is without significance, it is irrelevant. Anyway, I can't explain in one letter the full scope of what I am planning to do. In this book, I hope to describe a number of historical tendencies and how they affect individual behavior, in the manner I have attempted in this letter. More importantly, perhaps, I hope to describe not only what the problem is in historical terms, but where a possible solution might lie and what that solution conceivably could be, and I hope to describe it in a manner that makes its application possible. If you're interested in me telling you more, I can't always tell if someone is interested, then I will later. I don't know, Dad, but I think I've discovered something that no one else has any idea about, and I'm not sure I can do it justice. Its scope is so broad that I can only see parts of it clearly at one time, and it is exceedingly difficult to set down comprehensively in writing. You see, most of the kind of knowledge that I am trying to transmit verbally and logically has always been passed down from one person to another by means of art and music and religion and tradition, and not by rational explanation. And it is like translating from one language to another. It's not just a different language, though. It is an entirely different mode of experience. Anyway, I'm glad that you and Mum are doing well. Thank you for doing my income tax returns. Jordan. When I was finishing this manuscript, it had been almost 12 years since I first grasped the essence of the paradox that lies at the bottom of human motivation for evil. People need their group identification because that identification protects them, literally, from the terrible forces of the unknown. It is for this reason that every individual who is not decadent will strive to protect his territory, actual and psychological. But the tendency to protect means hatred of the other and the inevitability of war. And we are now too technologically powerful to engage in war. To allow victory to the other, however, or even continued existence on his terms, means subjugation, dissolution of protective structure, and exposure to that which is most feared. For me, this meant damned if you do, damned if you don't. Belief systems regulate affect, but conflict between belief systems is inevitable. Formulation and understanding of this terrible paradox devastated me. I had always been convinced that sufficient understanding of a problem, any problem, would lead to its resolution. Here I was, however, possessed of understanding that seemed not only sufficient but complete, caught nonetheless between the devil and the deep blue sea. I could not see how there could be any alternative to either having a belief system or to not having a belief system, and could see little but the disadvantage of both positions. This truly shook my faith. I turned in consequence to my dreams, acting on a tip from Jung, who had proposed that the dream might contain information when no other source could suffice. But my dreams dried up just when I needed them most, and no information was forthcoming. I was in a kind of stasis, at a standstill. This was very painful for me. I had spent several years intensely working and thinking, trying to understand individual human motivation for the worst possible human actions. I was doing what I truly believed was best, to the best of my ability, and doing it despite its substantial interference with my personal and professional lives. I had decided to devote my life to the problem of evil, to the development of a true understanding of evil, in the hopes of finding some means of combating it. Yet my search had come to a stop, a dead end. This did not seem reasonable. I truly believed I deserved better. Then, one night, my dreams came back with a vengeance. I had the following nightmare, as terrible and potent as the dreams of destruction that had started my quest several years before. I dreamed I was living in a two-story house. After a bout of heavy drinking, I went to the attic and fell asleep. After I fell asleep, I had the following dream, nested within a dream. I was trapped in a huge chandelier, which was hanging directly beneath the dome of an immense darkened cathedral. The chandelier hung hundreds of feet below its point of connection on the dome and was still so high off the ground that the people below on the floor looked like ants. These people were in charge of the cathedral, and I could tell that they were angry at me for being where I was. I did not feel guilty, because I was not there by choice. I just happened to have arrived there, and I wanted to leave. I realized I was dreaming, and shook myself awake as a means of removing myself from my uncomfortable position. But when I awoke, I still found myself suspended in the same place. I tried to deny this by falling back asleep, reasoning that it was better to be dreaming about this circumstance than to actually be trapped in it. However, I could not return to my previous unconscious state and stayed painfully awake. Then I found myself on the ground as a consequence of some process whose nature I cannot recall. The people of the cathedral protested my presence, but that didn't really bother me. All I wanted to do was get home where it was familiar and go back to sleep. When I returned home, I went into a small, windowless room, I think it was the furnace room, in the middle of the ground floor of my house. This room was surrounded by other rooms. It had no contact point with the outside. There was a small, single bed there that was actually much like my real bed. I crawled into it and tried to fall asleep, but a strange wind descended on me. Under its influence, I started to dissolve. I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that it was going to transport me back to the chandelier in the center of the cathedral. I attempted to fight the wind, but found that I was virtually paralyzed and in some sort of convulsion. I tried desperately to yell for help and actually awakened, at least partially. The windows behind my bed in my real room were wide open and a wind was blowing through them. I frantically closed them and then turned around. I was awake, but in front of me appeared a huge double door like that on a Gothic cathedral between my bedroom and the adjacent room, which were only partially separated. I shook myself, and the apparition disappeared. The terror I was experiencing vanished much more slowly. I had read much of the Gospels earlier that day, which might account for the initial reference to the drinking bout, the imbibing of spirit, so to speak. I formulated an interpretation of the dream, an essentially unacceptable formulation, immediately upon awakening. I knew that the word spirit had been derived from the Greek pneuma, which meant wind, the wind, for example, that moved upon the water in Genesis. The wind or breath that God blew into the Adama, the matter, to make man. I found myself at the central point of a cathedral in my dream, and I could not escape. A cathedral is sacred space designed to keep the forces of chaos at bay. It has the same layout as the cross. The central point of a cathedral is, symbolically, the place where Christ was crucified and the center of the universe simultaneously. All the forces embodied in my dream were conspiring to put me there awake, despite my best efforts to the contrary. I could not, at that time, accept the implications of that dream, could not believe the implications, and it has taken me a long time to assimilate its meaning. Carl Jung's comments are useful here. He that believeth on me, the works that I do, he shall do also, and greater works than these shall he do. John 14:12. The quotation from John is taken from the 14th chapter, where Christ teaches that whoever sees him sees the Father. He is in the Father, and the Father is in him. The disciples are in him, and he in them. Moreover, they will be sent the Holy Ghost as Paraclete, and will do works that are greater than his own. This 14th chapter broaches a question that was to have great repercussions for the future. The problem of the Holy Ghost, who will remain when Christ has gone, and who intensifies the interpenetration of the divine and the human to such a degree that we can properly speak of a Christification of the disciples. It is easy to see what happens when the logical conclusion is drawn from the 14th chapter of John. The opus Christi is transferred to the individual. He then becomes the bearer of the mystery. And this development was unconsciously prefigured and anticipated in alchemy, which showed clear signs of becoming a religion of the Holy Ghost and of the Sapientia Dei. Myths of the origin commonly portray the condition of paradise as the source of all things. The paradisal initial condition, disrupted by the events of the fall, also serves as the goal toward which history proceeds. Stories of the fall describe the introduction of uncontrollable anxiety into human experience as the consequence of traumatically heightened consciousness. As the result of irrevocably attained knowledge of human vulnerability and mortality. Re-establishment of paradise in the aftermath of such attainment becomes dependent upon manifestation of an exemplary way of behaving directed toward a meaningful end, becomes dependent upon establishment of a particular mode of redemption. Jung states, an old English legend reports what Seth saw in the Garden of Eden. In the midst of paradise there rose a shining fountain from which four streams flowed, watering the whole world. Over the fountain stood a great tree with many branches and twigs, but it looked like an old tree, for it had no bark and no leaves. Seth knew that this was the tree of whose fruit his parents had eaten, for which reason it now stood bare. Looking more closely, Seth saw that a naked snake without a skin had coiled itself round the tree. It was the serpent by whom Eve had been persuaded to eat of the forbidden fruit. When Seth took a second look at paradise, he saw that the tree had undergone a great change. It was now covered with bark and leaves, and in its crown lay a little newborn babe wrapped in swaddling clothes that wailed because of Adam's sin. This was Christ, the second Adam. He is found in the top of the tree that grows out of Adam's body in representations of Christ's genealogy. The tree, the Axis Mundi, is without bark and leaves because it has been mortally affected as a consequence of the fall. Production of its first fruit, self-reference, placed it in shock, exhausted its resources. Its second fruit, associated with re-emergence into lush life and health, is the Savior, the hero who redeems mankind from the consequences of the fall. The divine individual whose path of being leads back to paradise. This notion is represented imagistically, it has never really proceeded much past the image, in figure 67, the restitution of Christ, the mystic apple, to the tree of knowledge. A similar pattern of redemptive ideation informs the East. For Gautama, suffering and disenchantment are the necessary preconditions of adult enlightenment. The name of the Buddha, Siddhartha, literally means goal attained. The enlightened one, whose mode of being in the world transcends the suffering in that world, is an eternal spirit, that is, an eternally recurrent spirit, despite historical incarnation in the figure of the Buddha. Figure 68, the eternal return of the Bodhisattva, portrays this spirit, forever dominant over the mass of mankind and the great and terrible mother. The Bodhisattva, the central character in this figure, is an oriental Christ equivalent, or perhaps an image of the Paraclete or Holy Ghost. The creator of this work has superimposed the Bodhisattva on a tunnel in the sky ringed by transformative fire. This tunnel adds a temporal dimension to the spatial dimensions represented in the image and allows for the portrayal of the constant recurrence throughout time of the heroic spirit. This is a reflection of the same idea that drove Christian thinkers to attribute prehistorical and eternal reality to Christ despite his historical nature. As well, that drove speculation about the spirit of truth Christ left behind after his death. Myths of the fall and redemption portray the emergence of human dissatisfaction with present conditions, no matter how comfortable, and the tendency or desire for movement toward a better future. Such myths describe in narrative format how human beings think and will always think, regardless of time or place. The most profound of such cyclical myths portray heightening of consciousness as cause for emergent unrest. Simultaneously, such myths portray qualitatively transformed consciousness as cure for that unrest. More profoundly, portray participation in the act of qualitative transformation of consciousness as cure for that unrest. Proclivity deposit an ideal, implicitly or explicitly, to work toward its attainment, to become dissatisfied with its establishment as new matter makes itself manifest, and to thereby re-enter the cycle. This constitutes the centrally defining pattern of human abstraction and behavior. The simplest and most basic day-to-day human activities, invariably goal-directed, are necessarily predicated upon conscious or tradition-bound acceptance of a value hierarchy, defining the desired future in positive contrast to the insufficient present. To live from the human perspective is to act in light of what is valued, what is desired, what should be, and to maintain sufficient ignorance in a sense to allow belief in such value to flourish. Collapse of faith in the value hierarchy, or, more dangerously, collapse of faith in the idea of such hierarchies, brings about severe depression, intrapsychic chaos, and re-emergence of existential anxiety. The myth of the fall describes the development of human self-consciousness as a great tragedy, the greatest conceivable anomaly, an event that permanently altered the structure of the universe and doomed humanity to suffering and death. But it was this same fall that enabled the individual to adopt the redemptive role of the hero, the creator of culture, the same fall that lifted the curtain on the drama of human history. Whether or not it would have been better for humanity to have remained unconscious is no longer a point that can be usefully considered, although that path does not seem particularly productive for those who take it now. Original sin has tainted everyone. There is no way back. For much of human history, after the fall, so to speak, the individual remained firmly ensconced within the confines of a religious dream. A dream that gave meaning to the tragedy of existence. Many modern thinkers, including Freud, viewed that dream in retrospect as defensive, as a barrier of fantasy erected against the existential anxiety generated by knowledge of mortality. However, the dividing line between fantasy and reality is not so easily drawn. It is certainly possible to disappear voluntarily into the mists of delusion, to withdraw into the comforts of denial from a world terrible beyond what can be borne. Imagination is not always insanity, however, its use does not always imply regression. Imagination and fantasy allow each of us to deal with the unknown, which must be met before it is comprehended. Fantasy applied to consideration of the unknown is therefore not delusory. It is instead the first stage in the process of understanding, which eventually results in the evolution of detailed, empirical, communicable knowledge. Fantasy can be used to create the real world as well as the world of illusion. It all depends on who is doing the imagining and to what end. When pre-experimental man conceived of the unknown as an ambivalent mother, he was not indulging in childish fantasy. He was applying what he knew to what was unfamiliar but could not be ignored. Man's first attempts to describe the unknown cannot be faulted because they lacked empirical validity. Man was not originally an empirical thinker. This does not mean he was self-deluded, a liar. Likewise, when the individual worships the hero, he is not necessarily hiding from reality. It may also be that he is ready and willing to face the unknown as an individual, that he is prepared to adopt the pattern of heroic endeavor in his own life and to further creation in that manner. The great myths of Christianity, the great myths of the past in general, no longer speak to the majority of Westerners who regard themselves as educated. The mythic view of history cannot be credited with reality from the material, empirical point of view. It is nonetheless the case that all of Western ethics, including those explicitly formalized in Western law, are predicated upon a mythological worldview which specifically attributes divine status to the individual. The modern individual is therefore in a unique position. He no longer believes that the principles upon which all his behaviors are predicated are valid. This might be considered a second fall in that the destruction of the Western mythological barrier has re-exposed the essential tragedy of individual existence to view. It is not the pursuit of empirical truth, however, that has wreaked havoc upon the Christian worldview. It is confusion of empirical fact with moral truth that has proved of great detriment to the latter. This has produced what might be described as a secondary gain, which has played an important role in maintaining the confusion. That gain is abdication of the absolute personal responsibility imposed in consequence of recognition of the divine in man. This responsibility means acceptance of the trials and tribulations associated with expression of unique individuality, as well as respect for such expression in others. Such acceptance, expression, and respect requires courage in the absence of certainty and discipline in the smallest matters. Rejection of moral truth allows for rationalization of cowardly, destructive, degenerate self-indulgence. This is one of the most potent attractions of such rejection and constitutes primary motivation for the lie. The lie, above all else, threatens the individual and the interpersonal. The lie is predicated upon the presupposition that the tragedy of individuality is unbearable, that human experience itself is evil. The individual lies because he is afraid, and it is not the lies he tells another that present the clearest danger, but the lies he tells himself. The root of social and individual psychopathology, the denial, the repression, is the lie. The most dangerous lie of all is devoted to denial of individual responsibility, denial of individual divinity. The idea of the divine individual took thousands of years to fully develop and is still constantly threatened by direct attack and insidious counter-movement. It is based upon realization that the individual is the locus of experience. All that we can know about reality, we know through experience. It is therefore simplest to assume that all there is of reality is experience, its being and progressive unfolding. Furthermore, it is the subjective aspect of individuality, of experience, that is divine, not the objective. Man is an animal from the objective viewpoint, worthy of no more consideration than the opinion and opportunities of the moment dictate. From the mythic viewpoint, however, every individual is unique, is a new set of experiences, a new universe, has been granted the ability to bring something new into being, is capable of participating in the act of creation itself. It is the expression of this capacity for creative action that makes the tragic conditions of life tolerable, bearable, remarkable, miraculous. The paradise of childhood is absolute meaningful immersion. That immersion is a genuine manifestation of subjective interest. Interest accompanies the honest pursuit of the unknown in a direction and at a rate subjectively determined. The unknown in its beneficial guise is the ground of interest, the source of what matters. Culture, in its supportive role, extends the power with which the unknown can be met by disciplining the individual and expanding his range of ability. In childhood, the parent serves as cultural surrogate, and the child explores under the umbrella of protection provided by his parents. The parental mechanism has its limits, however, and must be superseded by the internalization of culture, by the intrapsychic incorporation of belief, security, and goal. Adoption of this secondary protective structure dramatically extends and shapes individual capability. The great dragon of chaos limits the pursuit of individual interest. The struggle with the dragon, against the forces that devour will and hope, constitutes the heroic battle in the mythological world. Faithful adherence to the reality of personal experience ensures contact with the dragon, and it is during such contact that the great force of the individual spirit makes itself manifest, if it is allowed to. The hero voluntarily places himself in opposition to the dragon. The liar pretends that the great danger does not exist to his peril and to that of others, or abdicates his relationship with his essential interest and abandons all chance at further development. Interest is meaning. Meaning is manifestation of the divine individual adaptive path. The lie is abandonment of individual interest, hence meaning. Hence divinity, for safety and security, is sacrifice of the individual to appease the great mother and great father. The lie is fear's statement in the face of genuine experience. That could not really be the case. That did not really happen. The lie weakens the individual, who no longer extends the range of his competence by testing his subjectivity against the world, and drains his life of meaning. Life without meaning is mortal limitation, subjection to pain and suffering without recourse. Life without meaning is tragedy without hope of redemption. The abandonment of meaning ensures the adoption of a demonic mode of adaptation, because the individual hates pointless pain and frustration and will work toward its destruction. This work constitutes revenge against existence, rendered unbearable by pride. Rebirth is re-establishment of interest after adoption of culturally determined competence. The rebirth of interest moves the individual to the border between the known and the unknown, and thereby expands the social world. In this manner, God acts through the individual in the modern world and extends the domain of history. Self-consciousness means knowledge of individual vulnerability. The process by which this knowledge comes to be can destroy faith in individual worth. This means, in concrete terms, that an individual may come to sacrifice his own experience in the course of development because its pursuit creates social conflict or exposes individual inadequacy. However, it is only through such conflict that change takes place, and weakness must be recognized before it can be transformed into strength. This means that the sacrifice of individuality eliminates any possibility that individual strength can be discovered or developed, and that the world itself might progress. Individuals whose life is without meaning hate themselves for their weakness and hate life for making them weak. This hatred manifests itself in absolute identification with destructive power in its mythological, historical, and biological manifestations. Manifests itself in the desire for the absolute extinction of existence. Such identification leads man to poison whatever he touches, to generate unnecessary misery in the face of inevitable suffering, to turn his fellows against themselves, to intermingle earth with hell, merely to attain vengeance upon God and his creation. The human purpose, if such a thing can be considered, is to pursue meaning, to extend the domain of light, of consciousness, despite limitation. A meaningful event exists on the boundary between order and chaos. The pursuit of meaning exposes the individual to the unknown in gradual fashion, allowing him to develop strength and adaptive ability in proportion to the seriousness of his pursuit. It is during contact with the unknown that human power grows, individually, and then historically. Meaning is the subjective experience associated with that contact in sufficient proportion. The great religious myths state that continued pursuit of meaning, adopted voluntarily and without self-deception, will lead the individual to discover his identity with God. This revealed identity will make him capable of withstanding the tragedy of life. Abandonment of meaning, by contrast, reduces man to his mortal weaknesses. Meaning is the most profound manifestation of instinct. Man is a creature attracted by the unknown, a creature adapted for its conquest. The subjective sense of meaning is the instinct governing rate of contact with the unknown. Too much exposure turns change to chaos. Too little promotes stagnation and degeneration. The appropriate balance produces a powerful individual, confident in the ability to withstand life, ever more able to deal with nature and society, ever closer to the heroic ideal. Each individual, constitutionally unique, finds meaning in different pursuits if he has the courage to maintain his difference. Manifestation of individual diversity, transformed into knowledge that can be transferred socially, changes the face of history itself, and moves each generation of man farther into the unknown. Social and biological conditions define the boundaries of individual existence. The unfailing pursuit of interest provides the subjective means by which these conditions can be met and their boundaries transcended. Meaning is the instinct that makes life possible. When it is abandoned, individuality loses its redeeming power. The great lie is that meaning does not exist or that it is not important. When meaning is denied, hatred for life and the wish for its destruction inevitably rules. As Christ has it in the Gospel of Thomas, "If you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you." The wisdom of the group can serve as the force that mediates between the dependency of childhood and the responsibility of the adult. Under such circumstances, the past serves the present. A society predicated upon belief in the paramount divinity of the individual allows personal interest to flourish and to serve as the power that opposes the tyranny of culture and the terror of nature. The denial of meaning, by contrast, ensures absolute identification with the group or intrapsychic degeneration and decadence. The denial of meaning makes the absolutist or degenerate individual desperate and weak when the great maternal sea of chaos threatens. This desperation and weakness makes them hate life and to work for its devastation in him as well as in those around him. The lie is the central act in this drama of corruption. These are the secret sayings which the living Jesus spoke and which Didymus, Judas, Thomas wrote down. And he said, "Whoever finds the interpretation of these sayings will not experience death." Jesus said, "Let him who seeks continue seeking until he finds. When he becomes troubled, he will be astonished, and he will rule over the all." Jesus said, "If those who lead you say to you, 'See, the kingdom is in the sky,' then the birds of the sky will precede you. If they say to you, 'It is in the sea,' then the fish will precede you. Rather, the kingdom is inside of you and it is outside of you. When you come to know yourselves, then you will become known, and you will realize that it is you who are the sons of the living Father. But if you will not know yourselves, you dwell in poverty, and it is you who are that poverty." Jesus said, "The man old in days will not hesitate to ask a small child, 7 days old, about the place of life, and he will live. For many who are first will become last, and they will become one and the same." Jesus said, "Recognize what is in your sight, and that which is hidden from you will become plain to you. For there is nothing hidden which will not become manifest." His disciples questioned him and said to him, "Do you want us to fast? How shall we pray? Shall we give alms? What diet shall we observe?" Jesus said, "Do not tell lies and do not do what you hate, for all things are plain in the sight of heaven. For nothing hidden will not become manifest, and nothing covered will remain without being uncovered." From the Gospel of Thomas. This is Jordan B. Peterson. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Maps of Meaning, The Architecture of Belief. This program was directed by Pedro Mendez, executive producer Dan Zitt. Text copyright 1919.